Today is Friday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Ethiopia's military has been ordered to start its final military operations in 72 hours if Tigray forces don't surrender. What's the impact on the conflict?
Presents, you know, potential, you know, very serious battle in and around Mekelle that could cause potentially mass suffering.
Plus, what does China hope to achieve with its disinformation campaign? And why hasn't an HIV vaccine been developed? We'll have these stories and more next. Ethiopia's military has been ordered to complete the final phase of a military offensive in the Tigray capital. After local forces did not surrender within a 72-hour deadline imposed by the prime minister. The Ethiopian army has been battling local forces in the Tigray region since November 4th, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent the National Defense Force into the area after accusing local forces of attacking a military base there. The Ethiopian government says the operation targets certain leaders of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the region's ruling party, while the TPLF says it is war on all of Tigray. Hundreds of people have been killed and more than 40,000 have fled to neighboring Sudan, recounting horrific tales of violence. For analysis of Ethiopia's worsening conflict, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group.
Well, as you know, it's been a little bit hard to work out exactly what's going on the ground with the communications blackouts, lack of humanitarian media access, etc. So we're just relying on both sides' accounts. What we do know, or what looks to be the case, is that there was serious fighting around sort of 70, 80 kilometers from Mekelle, the regional capital, yesterday. And so now it's a question, with the deadline expiring, the federal government is talking about an assault on Mekelle, obviously, to, you know, capture the Tigray leaders. So the question is, you know, when will that assault begin? And to what extent will Tigray's leaders try and defend Mekelle? They've not been in heavy urban fighting in other locations so far, but Mekelle is the regional government headquarters, so it looks likely that the Tigray's leaders will try and hold onto it, a civilian population of something like 500,000 people. So this obviously presents, you know, potential, you know, very serious battle in and around Mekelle that could cause potentially mass suffering.
Now, do the Tigray forces have the military capability to fight off what is essentially the full force of the Ethiopian army?
What we've seen so far is, you know, significant federal territorial gains broadly coming from the west towards the east. So that presumably shows that Tigray's forces cannot fight on every patch of the region. We do know that they are relatively well-armed. They still have manpower, firepower. They still seem to have some fuel supplies, despite their supply lines being cut off. So the question is, to what extent will they be able to defend this smaller geographic area, not just in and around Mekelle, but that sort of larger area towards the east of the region? There seems to be the possibility that they will be able to put up a certain amount of resistance. And even if they can't, then there is the possibility of some sort of fairly concerted insurgency developing from the remnants of the Tigrayan forces, even if the federal government takes control of Mekelle and other major urban areas and territories.
And looking at the Ethiopian federal government, why aren't they willing to negotiate?
Problem here is that obviously the federal government has been very clear about its objectives, to capture a certain section of the Tigrayan leadership, restore the integrity of the armed forces. So there's really no incentive whatsoever for those Tigrayan leaders to hand themselves in. And that's why instead they are likely to keep fighting. And the big question there is really, what level of support do they have from the rest of the government and the security apparatus and the Tigrayan people at large? There seems to be at least some chance that there will be a continued significant popular resistance to any imposed transitional government in Tigray. And then on the other side, the federal government has no interest, it says, in negotiating here, because it says that the crimes committed by the Tigrayan leadership, violations of the constitutional order in terms of this so-called illegal election, and then also the act which triggered the final act, which was the final trigger for the outbreak of conflict, which was the forceful Tigrayan takeover of sections of the federal military. The federal position is that this cannot go unpunished, that it will set a wrong precedent. It will incentivize other similar actions of rebellion. And that's why they are refusing any suggestion of a negotiated solution and rebuffing any offers of mediation in this conflict.
Now, there's a lot of international pressure to de-escalate the conflict. The African Union has sent envoys to Addis. The European Union's foreign minister called for de-escalation yesterday. Are these calls for mediation, for de-escalation having an effect?
Well, first of all, they are absolutely the right thing to do because this is at core a political dispute and needs to be resolved in that manner. And then we've talked about the potential devastation that could come. Unfortunately, as things stand, the federal government is set on trying to achieve its objectives via this military intervention. Until we see some significant shift, potentially, you know, maybe the federal government has to acknowledge that there is no quick, clean victory here, and its, you know, resources are being sapped by this conflict. Maybe there is increasing domestic discontent and increasing international pressure. Well, maybe that will provide an opening for these offers of mediation. But unfortunately, at the moment, we are set to see this conflict continue as the federal government tries to achieve its objectives, and the Tigrayans are set to keep struggling.
William Davison is a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group, and he was speaking to International Edition's Jason Patinkin. The United States intelligence community has well documented Russia's disinformation campaign since 2016, but as VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden tells me, they aren't the only ones carrying out operations.
Well, China is an interesting case because often when you hear top intelligence officials, counterintelligence officials talking, and to some extent even military officials, they'll say that over the long term, China is the number one threat. And China has been very active. They've been called out by the intelligence community and by the State Department's Global Engagement Center, which looks at propaganda, for the type of information or disinformation, if you will, that they've been putting out about the coronavirus and about where it started. There are two ways in which they've been doing this. Some of this has been an effort to shift the blame away from China. Under President Trump, the United States has focused on blaming China for the virus and for the spread of the virus quite a bit. So China's been trying to shift some of the blame away and put the blame on others. It's also been trying to make the United States look bad, perhaps sometimes look weak or ineffective in what it's done against the coronavirus or COVID-19. And they've also been trying to take information and create a sense of distrust in some of what the Western countries have been able to come up with in terms of a vaccine and efforts to fight the effort on that front, sometimes even trying to steal information about the vaccine to undermine it. So that's part of what China's been doing. But China's also been very active and was very active with the 2020 elections. But it approaches it differently than Russia. What top counterintelligence officials say, whereas Russia wants to sow distrust, chaos, and cause Americans to lose confidence in the process, China doesn't want to go that far. They say China wants to have Americans enter the voting booth, whether it was this past November 3rd for the presidential election or in future elections, with a more positive view of China, because ultimately China's economy needs the United States, and anything that destroys the United States or causes it to fall apart ultimately is not in China's best interest.
Now, Jeff, the other name that is often brought up with disinformation campaigns is Iran. So what can you share about Tehran's activities?
Right. Well, Iran has been very active with disinformation for a while, going back to 2018 when there were some nascent early efforts by the Iranians and Iranian-linked hackers to pick up on the Russian playbook for disinformation and cause chaos, confusion, try to shift the views of certain segments of the population, most notably the African-American population in the U.S. Those early efforts in 2018 didn't really resonate. And they've upped their game, though. And what we saw in the 2020 elections and just in the weeks before Americans went to the polls to cast their votes, the intelligence community came out and said Iran used their cyber proclivity to steal information from a state's voter registration database. And then they used that information to try to intimidate voters, pretending to be a far-right U.S. group, the Proud Boys, and targeting Democrats and just trying to instill some chaos. And intelligence officials say the hope there was that it would kind of leak back and reflect badly on President Trump, because the Iranians, whatever they may think of a Biden administration, knew that Trump was going to be playing hardball and he was doing policies that they wanted to see end.
When we talk about disinformation campaigns, is it only Russia, China, and Iran?
Counterintelligence officials say it's not just going to be the big three that we're talking about now. They say that for the 2020 elections, for example, there were about 30 countries in all that were seeking to influence the U.S. elections and to influence and change the way that American voters might be thinking as they made their decisions. A lot of them, including some allies, are picking up on the Russian playbook, trying to implement it to various degrees. And so part of the challenge for the intelligence community, the counterintelligence community in the United States, is how to interact with the public to make sure the public is acutely aware of where they're getting their information from and what that means. But with a lot of the other countries, countries like Venezuela, like Cuba, even U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia and Israel, we're not really seeing any labeling there. And there hasn't been a chance for researchers to do as much work. And some of that will be happening now that the election has passed, but there hasn't been a chance to do so much work to see exactly how they're trying to game the information, the news, social media ecosystem where all this is taking place.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. The United States registered its deadliest day from the coronavirus since May on Wednesday, with more than 2,100 deaths, while also adding nearly 200,000 infections to a wave of new cases that is by far the worst the country has experienced at any time during the pandemic. More than 89,000 people were hospitalized as of Wednesday, another record figure that comes amid worries that Thursday's U.S. Thanksgiving Day holiday will lead to even more infections with people traveling to gather with friends and family. There have been more than 60.4 million reported cases of the coronavirus worldwide, with 1.4 million deaths. South Korea, one of the early hotspots in the pandemic, is also in the midst of a new surge in cases, reporting more than 500 daily infections for the first time since March. In Germany, 15,000 people have died from the novel coronavirus. Chancellor Angela Merkel has urged Germans to remain patient with restrictions meant to slow the spread of COVID-19, while in Britain, many will continue to face tight restrictions in the weeks to follow its lifting of precautionary measures. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has this update.
Germany embarked on a so-called wave-breaker shutdown on November the 2nd, closing restaurants, bars, sports and leisure facilities, but leaving schools, shops and hair salons open. It was initially slated to last 4 weeks, but Merkel and the country's 16 state governors agreed to extend it through to December 20th to try to push down the regional infection rates. Germany, which has 83 million people, was credited with a relatively good performance in the first phase of the pandemic and still has a lower death rate than several other European countries. UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock urged English citizens to stick to the rules.
To keep people safe and to keep the gains that are being made, more areas than before will be in the top two tiers. This is necessary to protect our NHS and keep the virus under control.
More than half of England's 56 million people, including London's 8.6 million residents, are in the middle level, where most shops, restaurants and leisure businesses can open with some restrictions. Another 23 million people in a huge chunk of central and northern England will be placed in the top tier. Under these, the toughest rules, pubs and restaurants can only serve takeout and delivery, and leisure venues such as cinemas and bowling alleys must stay closed. Karen Chamas, London.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy went on trial Thursday to face corruption charges. Sarkozy is accused of trying to bribe a judge to obtain information about an investigation into his 2007 presidential campaign. The former head of state insists he is innocent. Nicolas Pinault reports.
It is not every day that you see a former president walking in a courtroom with his lawyers to stand trial. This unusual scene is going on in Paris, where Nicolas Sarkozy is facing charges of bribery and influence peddling. Jean-Claude Beaujeu is a lawyer of the France-Amérique Association. He details the case for VOA.
It's very unusual for a former head of state in France to be prosecuted for corruption. Former President Sarkozy is suspected of having attempted to bribe a high-ranking judge in exchange for information in an ongoing judicial case concerning Nicolas Sarkozy himself.
Prosecutors say Sarkozy promised a plush job in Monaco to a judge in exchange for inside information on a separate inquiry into claims he accepted illicit payments from L'Oréal Harris, Liliane Bettencourt, during his 2007 presidential campaign. Sarkozy has always denied the accusation. Judges are basing their case on evidence recorded from wiretapes of phone conversations between Sarkozy and his lawyer. They are part of another probe into suspected Libyan financing of Sarkozy's 2007 campaign. The former one-term French president contests the legality of wiretapping. He defended himself earlier this month in an interview with French channel BFM TV.
Toute ma vie privée a fait l'objet de ces écoutes. Qu'on écoute.
Sarkozy regrets that all his private life was wiretapped. According to him, it is scandalous that attorney-client privilege was not respected, as phone conversations are protected by the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence. I am not a crook, and what I'm going through is a scandal, Sarkozy insisted. The trial is expected to last 3 weeks. If found guilty, Sarkozy could face a prison sentence of up to 10 years and a fine of $1.2 million. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
A convicted terrorist has had his Australian citizenship canceled by authorities in Canberra. Phil Mercer reports that Algerian-born Abdul Nasser Bembrika was jailed for 12 years in 2008 for his role in a plot to attack targets in the state of Victoria and New South Wales.
Abdul Nasser Bembrika is the first person to be stripped of Australian citizenship while in the country. Others who've had their citizenship cancelled were overseas when the orders were made. Authorities still consider Bembrika to be a threat to Australia. He was arrested in 2005, along with 17 other suspects, and charged with planning multiple attacks on Australian soil, including on a nuclear reactor in Sydney, a casino in Melbourne, and a major sporting final. He was found guilty of terrorism offences and sent to prison for 15 years. His sentence expired November 5, but he remains behind bars under an interim detention order. He's expected to be deported to Algeria, where he was born, and has 90 days to appeal the decision to cancel his citizenship. Opposition Labour Senator Penny Wong says she supports the decision to deport the convicted extremist.
We did understand when we passed those laws through the Parliament that the cancellation of citizenship was a big step, but a necessary step in certain circumstances. And Mr. Bembrika's activities and his conviction are well known to all of us. And that is why Labor supported the passage of that legislation.
The deportation of convicted terrorists is not universally popular in Australia. Spy chiefs fear that stripping them of citizenship might increase the global threat of extremism by simply exporting dangerous individuals with radical views to other countries. They've urged the Australian government to use its powers sparingly to avoid unintended consequences. Bembrika has lived in Australia since 1989. While he remains in prison in Victoria, he's been granted an ex-citizen visa. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And coming up later...
Even though we're in a pandemic, it's important that the kids are still able to be kids and still keep up with the regular traditions.
It was good that we got to see him in person, even if they couldn't sit on his lap.
This is VOA News.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to let you know that I am moving on from VOA's International Edition and will be starting a brand new opportunity with another very worthy organization. It has been an honor and a privilege to bring you the objective, reliable news and information that you deserve. My fellow journalists here at VOA know that a free press is often a lifeline for truthful reporting, which is at the heart of freedom and democracy. And while we've never met personally, I thank you so much for sharing some of your day with me through these years. You're in great hands. I wish you all the very best in health and happiness. This is Lori London signing off one last time. Kwa heri na asante.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The UN Program on HIV and AIDS warns stigma and discrimination against marginalized populations are driving both the AIDS crisis and COVID-19, and must be tackled and eliminated to end what officials call the dual colliding pandemics. In a report released in advance of World AIDS Day on December 1st, the UN agency calls on governments to put the most vulnerable at the center of their pandemic responses. Lisa Schlein has more.
It is nearly 40 years since HIV/AIDS emerged. While progress in the treatment of the disease has been made, AIDS remains a public health menace. Last year, UNAIDS reported 1.7 million people were infected with HIV and 690,000 died. Health officials report the global response to ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 was off track even before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. The rapid spread of coronavirus, they say, is creating additional setbacks. Part of UNAIDS' new strategy for tackling AIDS is to direct money to the people most at risk. Yet Minister for Foreign Trade and Development Cooperation in the Netherlands, Sigrid Kaag, says that is not happening. She notes a study commissioned by the Netherlands finds only 2% of AIDS funding worldwide targets those who are most at risk.
62% of new HIV infections are among gay men, sex workers, drug users, and transgender people. How can we end the HIV pandemic, or any pandemic for that matter, if we ignore those most at risk? Stigma and criminalization impede access to medical services. And this is exactly how pandemics continue to spread.
East and Southern Africa is the region most heavily affected by HIV. The region is home to nearly 21 million out of the 38 million people living with HIV worldwide. It notes 12 million are not receiving treatment for their illness. Yet even under these circumstances, countries such as Eswatini and Botswana in sub-Saharan Africa, Cambodia and Thailand in Asia have made remarkable progress in tackling the deadly disease by implementing people-centered policies. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima says governments must focus on helping the most vulnerable, marginalized people. She says they must target preventive measures, sexual, reproductive, and other health services toward them, and not just implement policies that are politically palatable.
We're going to have to be more focused, focusing on the hotspots, not choosing what we want to address because that's what we are comfortable with, but being evidence-based, targeting closely where the risk is, not where we don't want to see.
Byanyima says governments also must focus on reducing the inequalities that are the drivers of HIV and COVID-19. She says more investment must be made in strengthening health systems and providing treatment and care to all in need. She says respecting the human rights of people most at risk is crucial in beating back the twin pandemics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Roche Marc Christian Kabore will serve another 5 years as Burkina Faso's president. That's according to provisional results announced by the National Independent Electoral Commission. Kabore is said to have won with nearly 58% of the vote. The opposition had hoped to split the vote and deprive Kabore of the 51% needed for an outright victory and then form a coalition behind the strongest candidate for a second round of votes. As suicide rates in South Korea climb and taboos about death begin to soften, there's a growing demand in conservative South Korea for women's bodies to be handled by other women. Reuters' Francesca Lenaw has that story.
South Korea used to consider death as a taboo in the past, and had a negative perception on whether women could handle such work. But the perception has been changing.
Back in the 2000s, only a third of Lee Jong-woo's embalming students were women. Now, 60% of his classroom is female. The reason? There's a growing demand in conservative South Korea for women's bodies to be handled by other women. 30-year-old Park Bo-ram is a funeral director in Seoul.
Most deaths in young people are suicides. Many of them are women. And the families of the bereaved, especially if it was the suicide of a woman, feel more comfortable if female funeral directors handle the body.
Student Park Se-young, who volunteered to lie in a casket for her classmates to practice on her, said she would only want a female mortician to handle her body after her death.
I sure wouldn't want male undertakers to touch, wash and dress my naked body, even if I were dead. I am determined I should be the one bidding those women a proper farewell.
While women continue to make strides in once male-dominated work, there is a lingering resistance against women doing the job. 21-year-old Shin Hwa-jin plans to work at a funeral home after graduation, but understands that not everyone is comfortable with the idea.
One of the most shocking things I heard from the alumni is what one of them heard from her mother-in-law. She said, "How dare you think of cooking my meals with those hands that touched a dead body?" That was so shocking.
South Korea has the highest suicide rate in the OECD. In 2019, there were 24.6 deaths per 100,000 inhabitants, compared to an OECD average of 11.3. That, coupled with the fact there's a growing concern surrounding suicide in women in their late teens and 20s, means requests for female funeral directors are likely to rise further.
Francesca Lena reports for Reuters News. Friday, the day after Thanksgiving in the United States, kicks off the unofficial holiday shopping season. One American shopping tradition is for stores to have displays featuring Santa Claus, where children can sit on his lap and then share their wishes with the jolly old elf. Despite a raging pandemic, some mall owners in America are going ahead with plans to bring Santa back this year. But as Mariama Diallo reports, visitors will see a lot of precautions.
Malls and retail stores are doing all they can to bring back jolly old Santa and to keep the families who meet him safe from the coronavirus. This year, Santa must wear a face shield and there is no sitting on his lap. Moms say they're still happy to make the trip.
Even though we're in a pandemic, it's important that the kids are still able to be kids and still keep up with the regular traditions.
It was good that we got to see him in person, even if they couldn't sit on his lap.
A Barbie doll. A unicorn.
An acrylic barrier provides an extra layer of protection, but it sometimes makes it hard to hear each other, says Don Lemmy, one of the Santas.
The experience this year obviously is going to be the glass in front of the harder of hearing for wishes from the children, which are normally soft-spoken to start with. But everybody here seems to be doing a good job as far as keeping their social distancing and respecting everybody's health.
The barrier, which gets cleaned between visits by Santa's helper, is glare-free, so the keepsake picture comes without the camera's flash.
It was the best time I ever had.
I mean, Santa's going to come and get me a lot of presents.
Yes.
Loretta Mercado, a chain store general manager, says the company couldn't go without Santa this year, but it had to be done in a safe manner.
It was very important that we had all the safety features in place, all the social distancing, temperature taking, you know, the wonderful things we have to offer between, you know, Santa Wonderland's shield here and the cleaning that we do between each and every guest.
But not everybody has opted to bring back the tradition. Macy's canceled its in-person visits this year, saying it couldn't provide a safe environment for the more than a quarter million people who normally come to see Santa at its New York flagship store. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a fantastic Friday.